Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 210, featuring John Hewitt. John and I have been great and old friends for a long time. Not to imply that John and I are old, although we're definitely on the senior side of the visual effects world. John is an absolutely amazing person that I first met at Digital Domain on probably the first film that I really got involved in lighting the most. And John taught me a lot about lighting from his point of view and from all of his experience, which was invaluable to me at the time. And then when things started to go towards ray tracing, I sort of returned a favor and applied all the things that I learned from John and applied them to ray tracing. And I tried to teach John a little bit about the ray tracing world of things. So it was a really fascinating exchange. And like I said, a long time friendship with John, but he he's an incredibly kind person with his time. He is a very humble person. He is, I mentioned some of his work that he's done in visual effects, but he's actually done an enormous amount of work in the previs world these days. That's really what he gets involved with. He's done some work on some incredible films and has a really big background in the world of industrial design and other things. So he's actually a very creative person as well. I just absolutely love John. He's a really, really great guy. And I think you'll be able to tell very quickly what a cool guy he is. All right. I don't really have any announcements in terms of products right now. We don't have any products that we can announce at this very moment. But we do have Total Chaos that's happening. And I mentioned it last time, but Total Chaos is happening in Sofia, which will be in May 16th through 18th in Sofia. And it was a big success last year, and we're expecting an even bigger success this year. And we started announcing a few of the speakers. We have many more to come, but I figured I'd tell you a little teaser of some of the ones that are out there in no particular order, and certainly there's others that are coming as well. But Victor Hugo will be there, who is an absolutely wonderful guy. First time I met Victor Hugo was at THU, which is Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn, a few years ago. And he's really, really great. And he's a character artist from São Paulo that does really, really wonderful work. And speaking of THU, Andre Luiz, the CEO of THU, is actually going to be there and talk about his inspiration of why he decided to create this little tribe that he made for THU. And it's a really wonderful story. I'm very excited that Andre is going to be able to come there and share some of his experience over at Total Chaos. A couple other people here that I want to talk about, mention, is Stu Bailey from Real Time UK. Really excited to hear what the Real Time UK's guys are up to and what the wonderful work that they're doing. Andrew Maximov, who from Promethean, who is does incredible work in terms of asset creation using AI. I mean, he has completely rethought the way that we think about creating things using a complete deep learning system that is mainly driven through a much more sort of phrase-based UI. Fascinating stuff. In fact, I am actually going to record a podcast with Andrew, I think, next week. So that's a podcast that will be coming out. So it'll probably be coming out before Total Chaos. And you guys should totally check it out. Very excited to have Andrew as a speaker at Total Chaos as well. We also have some great speakers coming from Juice, which is a visual effects company out of Poland. Really excited to see them there. On the architecture side, we have some very exciting people there. We're going to have someone from Zaha Hadid Architecture. Everyone knows who Zaha Hadid Architecture is. And also from KPF, a really, really well-renowned architecture firm as well. And I think the only other thing I'm going to say is that we actually have a really interesting blog post that's coming out this week, which I'm excited about, which is about the newest portrait that Ian Sprigg has done. Ian Spriggs and I have been working very closely to sort of create, do stuff on digital human work. And he's obviously, as you guys know, does amazing human portraiture all in CG. And we've been testing out some new technology, some new hardware. And thanks to our friends over at NVIDIA and Lenovo, we set them up with a really, really nice rig that he's been able to really hammer on some V-Ray GPU stuff for character work, and it's just absolutely incredible. So very exciting to put that blog post out there. So go to chaosgroup.com and go to our blog section and go look at the Ian Spriggs blog post we did. He did an absolutely amazing portrait of Scott Eaton, and I just blown away. All right, guys, that is all I have to say in terms of announcements, but I hopefully you guys will enjoy this fabulous podcast with my very good friend, John Hewitt. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
How are you doing?
Good. I'm excellent. After conquering my double-headed dragon of a cold since the holidays.
Yeah, but you got through it.
I did. I took a lot of garlic, and I postponed my podcast interview a few times.
Well, I appreciate you doing this. It was interesting running into you at Stouts, because we went there because Lon and I had a meeting in Hollywood, and he said, "Oh, I've heard of this place that's got some really good beers named Stouts." And we ended up going there, and then who would I run into but you?
Yes, me and another cohort.
Yeah.
Another old blast from our past.
Yeah. It was awesome to see you guys. And then suddenly I said, "Oh my gosh, of course I would run into you here, because you always were a beer connoisseur of some sort."
Oh yes, yeah. Actually, I've got at home sitting in a box. It's pretty massive, so it hasn't been installed yet. But I have a micro brewing machine that you just put these capsules in. It's a bit like a Keurig or an espresso.
I saw this on CES.
You can buy these kits and brew your own beer at home.
But doesn't it take like 2 weeks to brew?
Well, the traditional method does, but I think it's faster than that. But honestly, I'm kind of afraid to set it up, because my wife, you know, she's like that condo on Netflix. Like, she's a minimalist, and like any more things I add to our countertops, I just think I might be paying for it in the long run. So it's still sitting in the box. I'm trying to figure out what to do with it. You know, it may end up going in storage, and then maybe I visit my sister and I'll drive it home to her. So.
Now, it's funny that you, of all people, call someone a minimalist, because you're a pretty big minimalist.
Apparently not anymore. My standards have been reset. Yeah, my wife has pointed out all my manchkies, if you want to call them that.
Manchkies?
Laying around. For starters, I've got 5 bicycles in our bedroom, because I have this habit of building bicycles.
No. That does not sound like the John Hewitt I know.
Well, no. I mean, but the bedroom is kind of like a hidden space, so right. I'm okay with that, and she's okay with that too, but I just can't add more things. Like, anytime I get something new, I have to get rid of something. So
right,
that's a mantra there at the Hewitt.
You have
household.
To ask yourself: does it spark joy?
Yes, I ask myself that, but I guess one person's joy is another's, you know,
dilemma,
misery,
yeah, conundrum.
Yeah,
that's interesting. It's funny. So, but I like I said, I have known you for a while. The first time that. I mean, the first time I really, I guess, got to know you was at the very, I just finished Day After Tomorrow, and I started working on iRobot.
Yep. Yeah, we were neighbors.
Paul George said, I'm going to introduce you to John Hewitt, because he's working on the lighting of the robots and the look dev of it. And I said, okay. And so that's when I really got to know you and understand that. And you were the...
And at the time, the world of Render Man.
Yeah.
I was always flummoxing you with my, this is how you have to do it in Render Man.
Right.
I remember that.
Well, that you became of an important part of my Render Man education, right? I understood, okay.
And you of my V-Ray education.
Right. So I learned so much about Render Man through you. And about the process of what it was, and about shaders and shading networks. And you were known for fairly complex shading networks at that
yes,
time.
Yes, they live in infamy in people's memories.
Right. But they were really interesting, and I learned so much. And you walked me through, you know, it looked like a spider web of stuff, but then you walked me through it, and it's like, oh, this all makes sense. Like, this is really well thought out. So...
Yeah, and I can't say that it was academic. I mean, I didn't start in that. That's not where I started my career in visual effects, but it ended up there. And it's not there anymore. And now I'm somewhere completely different. But
sure. But this was the beginning. This is when I started. You know, I obviously got to know you at a certain position in your point in your career, which and there's a long journey that's there. But that's the point where I met you, right? Yep. That's where I got to know you.
Yep, yep.
And I learned so much from you. And then you and I became really great friends. And then I started, you know, we'd go hang out and have lunch together or have a beer together.
Oh, yeah, many times.
Many lunches and many beers.
Firehouse sessions.
And you and I and Charles Abouad were going out for coffee like almost every day.
Yep. Yeah, I still talk to Charles almost every day.
Yeah.
We text almost every day.
Oh, know? That's nice.
Yeah, he's really enjoying himself up there in Vancouver.
That's good.
For people who know Charles Abouad.
Yeah, he was a really talented artist and person as well.
CG Soup up at Sony right now.
Really?
Yep.
Did he work on Spider-Man?
He did.
Wow.
CG supervisor on the Spideyverse.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow. That's
one of the main honchos up there.
Really?
Yeah. Well, and I love that movie.
That movie is
so good. I'm not a
Spider-Man
guy, but I love that movie.
I know what you mean. Well, I like Spider-Man, but that brought everything to a new level. Actually brought all, honestly speaking, if Marvel went there, that would be exciting to me. Marvel became an art film.
It was. And, you know, for being an animated graphic novel, it was the most beautiful rendition of that. Like what you would always want it to be when you watch any Marvel movie and you see the opening credits and, you know, you kind of have the nostalgia of how those films open. But this movie is that way from start to finish.
Yeah. And even really more well so. The only word of caution I would say is that if you are prone to any kind of seizures,
yeah,
be careful.
Yes,
because it is.
I would second that. Yeah,
it was. It's a bright and exciting.
Yeah, your eyes will be surprised.
Yeah, it's. But it is. And if you're not, then it is pure eye candy. It's just amazing.
Yeah,
really great.
Loved it.
Really great stuff.
I imagine they had a few extra AOVs or frame buffers in that movie.
They could
to finish that.
could be. I don't know. It was really, really cool to see that. Anyways,
where were we?
Charles and you and I would hang out together. And I got to learn a lot about your career during that time. And what's interesting about doing this podcast is that often I actually go into doing interviews with people that I've worked with. And then I realize I don't really know much about their history. But I do actually know about your history because you and I have chatted about it for a while.
I might have unloaded on you a few of those long nights there in the warehouse. I probably went on a few rants, so you probably know more than most.
But from you know, obviously I know about your career over at Art Center and how that turned into a career in automotive. But since the listeners don't know, how did that start? Like, why did you end up going to Art Center? What got you fascinated into that?
Well, world? I mean, for me, I never had any question my entire life what I wanted to do for a living. And I was, you know, probably 8, 9, 10 years old, and that was to be an industrial designer and a car designer specifically. But industrial design was also a part of that interest.
Right.
And I never had a doubt, and everything I did in my life from that point on, I was, you know, watching movies and drawing things that I saw in the films. I think the first one I saw like on television was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I drew the Nautilus, and I was watching these old Godzilla movies that my elementary school was screening for us, and everything was just imprinting in my head, and I couldn't get out of my head. So I was stuck with this curse of not being able to forget the way certain things looked and trying to reproduce them at home. And I remember my mother had bought me a drawing board and some drawing equipment, and I started, I wasn't sketching. I was sketching as a little kid, you know, kind of the typical nonsense that you might expect. And then once I got into drafting and then doing more technical stuff, and then I started to get more serious about it. And so that was a curse I had coming home from high school and not wanting to study anything, I would just sit down in front of the TV and watch some stupid TV show that had nothing to do with what I was drawing, but I was constantly drawing like motorcycles and cars and engines and aircraft and spaceships. And, you know, it was like literally something I couldn't stop myself from doing. And I would do it from coming home at, you know, from school on Friday until Sunday night when I had to go to bed. And I was just constantly, you know, I have like all these like pockmarks in my hands that are little imprints of lead from dropping a super sharp drawing pencil onto my, you know, like stabbing myself inadvertently, right. You know, it's these little tattoos from this addiction I had of drawing. So it kind of all started there. And then, you know, as I grew older and practically growing up in Idaho, how do you engage yourself to get trained in a career like this? And I had no idea. And I had a subscription to Road and Track magazine, and there was an article about Art Center in it. And I think I was maybe 14, 15 years old. And I saw the article and I read it, and I'm like, oh my God, this is what I was meant to do.
This was the school for me.
Yeah. And I had no doubts. It was just, so I showed my father, and my father wasn't particularly impressed. And
right.
I come from a family of bankers, and you know, bankers tend to not understand industrial design. They tend to think of it as art, you know, which is kind of a non-productive endeavor. And, you know, the way I didn't think about it that way.
But I don't, that's interesting that you say that, because I've always had this argument too, because a lot of people think of like, you know, I want to be an quote unquote artist. And then everyone who doesn't understand art says they think of the starving artist, right?
Exactly.
And so that's a problem.
That's like what you have to escape when, especially when you're growing up in a place like Idaho, you know, because you don't find a lot of artists in Idaho, and they are there and there's some great ones, but generally, you know, you're going to get frowned upon by your family. And of course your mother is always going to tell you, oh, it's whatever he likes, you know, but the dad just, you know, he didn't understand it. And so he just put the article away. And I don't know if he read it. He probably didn't. But, so at that point in my life, that's when you go chasing, waterfalls, you know, it's like right. when you're trying to figure out, well, what's going to make my father happy, and you're not thinking about yourself. And so for the next, 8-9 years, I ended up forgetting about it. And I went to a different school and I studied different subjects, and I was studying like genetics at Oregon State University, and, you know, ended up going into sociology, behavioral sciences, business marketing, kind of all this mishmash of things to try and figure out what to do with myself. And, but at the same time I was doing things like taking German because I thought, well, maybe one day I'll be a car designer and work for, you know, Porsche. I was doing little things to kind of keep stoking the fire. Mm-hmm. And, but I just found myself at one point where, you know, I was getting married to a girl who was, enrolled at Pepperdine Law School. And, you know, thankfully she picked Pepperdine, you know,
right.
because that kind of put me closer to Art Center.
Right.
And, you know, we moved down here together, and, we had all of our possessions crammed into a 79 Saab 900 Turbo, which uh-huh. has like an emerald green velour interior, you know, like this kind of crazy emerald green glass. And so even the light that came through the windows was filtering into the interior.
It felt like
you had reached the end of Wizard of Oz, you know, and it was a beautiful thing. But we had like all of our possessions in there. We had our cat, and, you know, we were flying down the 101.
Right.
And this car had 120,000 miles on it. It was my second Saab. I love Saabs, you know, starting the car.
Rest in peace.
Yes. Well, that's where I'm going.
Yeah.
You know, you start to think between the seats. Like, there's all these weird quirks. The clutch is on the wrong side of the motor, and, you know, the belts are in the front. I mean, the belts are in the back and the clutch is in the front. There's all these things about the car that don't make any sense. But we're flying down the 101, and I was doing about 70, and, you know, she's in the car, the cat's in the car, all of our stuff is in the car. We have another truck following us.
Right.
But I hear this, like, chudder from the motor, and I knew that I was having a weird thing with the turbocharger. I was getting, like, crazy horsepower, and I just remember enjoying myself, like, the car feels like it's got 100 more horsepower than normal, and so I was, like, goosing the throttle, and I was like speeding up and slowing down and speed, just enjoying the acceleration. And like, this is really strange. And we have all this stuff in the car.
Right.
This is not right. Something is definitely not right. And so I probably the fourth time I did that, I heard this noise come from the engine, and it was like a really hard clack. And I immediately knew something bad went wrong. And so I threw the car into neutral. And I was flying down the freeway and the engine just was not running. It was basically, there was no sound. We were going 65 miles an hour in silence, kind of like your Tesla. Right. And, but this was a 79 Saab, so this obviously is not
Does not make any sense. Yeah.
And so I think it was Lost Hills Canyon exit was coming up. So I took the exit and the off-ramp is uphill and it was enough to slow us down. And I mean, the brakes still work, fortunately, but they're power brakes. So, you know, they're not as strong as normal.
Right.
And I coasted up to the top of the hill and pulled over and that was it. That car was done. And I thought about it. It's like, do I really want to try to fix this? And I think I was engaged in an email thread with a friend of mine about fixing these old cars. And I told him the same story. That's the good thing that this came up because I need to tell the story again. But I ended up selling the car to like a mobile station mechanic for like $700. And so that's how I got to California. But yeah, so anyways, get back to your question. My wife and I at the time, we, you know, she started Pepperdine and I was, I just got hired by Volkswagen of America and I was working as an inventory analyst using my, this is my business degree, the first degree I got. Mm-hmm. And so we were both kind of happily engaged in our life. We had, you know, plenty of things to keep us busy and Volkswagen was a good job and I was getting to know the company and I thought this will get me closer to being a designer, even though I hadn't studied it. And over time, I started to realize like, you know, there's no way to get there from here, even though I was working for Volkswagen, Audi.
Right.
And I realized that, you know, I'm going to have to go back and, you know, I'm not, the company Volkswagen of America is a subsidiary, but they're not Volkswagen AG.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which if I were to see if I could get my education in automotive design, I would have to somehow like lobby them to send me back to school. And I was able to get them to agree to night school. So I started taking night courses. And that they had just done the General Motors Design Laboratory at Art Center. So there was a bunch of computers in that lab, the old SGI.
Yeah.
They had the Reality Engine in there, which was the size of a refrigerator, but it didn't do a lot compared to what you can do now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had indies and, you know, we had like, I think the O2 wasn't out yet, but so anyways, that's kind of how I started. But I got to a point where I had taken the night course and I was able to put my portfolio together and, they really, didn't see any way for me to start as a full-time student because the transportation program at Art Center is very intense and you can't work at the same time. And Volkswagen stipulated that you have to work full-time for them to reimburse your tuition. So there was just, and you could only take your classes during the day.
Right.
So I realized the only way I was going to be able to do this was to quit.
Right.
But I didn't quit. I took vacation.
Okay.
And so I took vacation and I began another class at Art Center, an alias class. And my first class at Art Center that they paid for was like portfolio stuff.
Okay.
And I did put a portfolio together and it, you know, was well enough received. But I took the alias class for you know, actually, let me back up. I took the alias class at night, and then I quit, and I applied for a job to help a friend out who had graduated by this time at Warner Brothers on Eraser.
Right.
And so I ended up working at Warner Brothers. This is a while ago. I'm jogging my memory a bit.
Right.
But I worked at Warner Brothers for 3 weeks while I was on vacation from Volkswagen. And at the end of my vacation, I did a bunch of work for the movie Eraser, building all these sets and props and stuff for the rail gun, which had an X scope on it. You could see through walls and everything.
Right.
And at the end of the 3 weeks, I had the most stressful conversation with a couple of guys I work with at Warner Brothers. And they're like, so do you think I could come in on Monday?
Right.
Because basically I was going to have to quit my job.
Right.
And they kind of, they talked for a bit and they said, let's talk about it. And I left the room and then, you know, the guys, one of the guys is still a good friend of mine. And the other guys at Weta, Guy Williams, I think is like a shader, head of shader development or head of technology at Weta maybe.
Okay.
And then the door opened and they said, yeah, I think you can come in, you know. And then so then I knew I could quit my job. Okay. So I quit the job at Volkswagen, and that's how I entered into visual effects.
Interesting.
And but there was I really crammed the timeline down quite a bit. But in the middle of all that, there was me going to Art Center for several semesters and taking classes and all the core curriculum stuff.
Right.
I never got to the point where I was designing any cars, although I did a few projects that were not like – there weren't corporate sponsored projects, but they did. I did projects on my own in class time.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was that's kind of the roundabout way I made my way – into entertainment. But I guess the moral of the story is, you know, I was always concerned about the what and not the how. And so in visual effects, it's usually about the how. The yes. what is predetermined in post-production visual
yes,
effects.
It is. Yeah.
And so I think the challenge I always had is how do I keep myself engaged and entertained with the what? And I ended up working for some smaller companies that kind of give you a lot of freedom, and you know, maybe they didn't hire concept artists, or maybe so there was a lot of little experiments I could play on my own using my newfound skills, you know, in Alias as a modeler, and just to be able to design and build things, and sometimes they'd end up in the movie.
Right.
So yeah, it's kind of a, I don't know if that explanation made much sense.
Well, I think it does, because I mean when I met you on iRobot, you were doing a lot of the what, right? They didn't really know how this robot would look.
Yeah, the surfacing what, that
the
part of
surfacing
the what,
what yeah. right? And it was, you know, they had a reference. They had a practical version of the robot.
Yeah.
That looked okay. Honestly, the CG version looked nicer.
Did you see the early versions that were done?
No.
The chin, I think the Totopolis, actually some pretty interesting work, you know.
Really?
But just a little bit too controversial for the big screen, but.
Why was it controversial?
There was one that had like a, almost like a kabuki mask face, and the chin was this long proboscis, it kind of extended out. And,
right.
And then even before that, I think there might have been some, I'm trying to remember some of the old concept, but a lot of it was incredible work. It just was too, a little too abstract, I think, for, you know, what the director was looking for.
Right. Yeah. But I do remember very specifically some of that work. It was amazing. And one of, you know, obviously, you know.
And also they brought in like Andy Jones, the animation director, yep. who yep. was also very helpful to kind of like pin down what the character should be and how it should look.
Absolutely.
And how it should emote and relate to the audience. And
Yeah. No, he was really critical. And I became, you know, close with Andy from that, because of that project as well, which was really, really nice. But I do remember, you know, you had already been quite far along on the look development side of the robots when I came in, and I learned a huge amount from you, and we were just starting to transition into actual shot production at that time. So I was sort of getting into that and understanding that. And then you were then transitioning to also being shot production stuff. So there was, you know, a couple of lighting leads, and you became a lighting lead, and I became a lighting lead as well. And so I was focused on a certain area, and you were focused on a different area. And you started to light a lot of the very, you know, emotional parts of the movie.
Yes. And that's one of the highlights of my career was getting that interrogation lab sequence, because for one thing, it helped define what the character looked like and solving a lot of the technical problems of the surface.
Right.
Because you needed to be able to, you know, perceive the dialogue and read the facial expressions.
Right.
And yet, you know, you had a translucent character, but you wanted this character to connect with the audience. And that was a big thing that we had to work through.
Just so people know, this was a scene in the movie, which was a very critical scene where the robot himself was brought in for questioning by the policeman, who was the hero of the movie, is played by Will Smith. And they take him into an interrogation room to interrogate him like a person. But the lighting was hard.
Yeah, just very simple overhead.
Kind of thing that you would expect in an interrogation room in a police room. But there was a lot of complicated things to figure out at that time because this was before we were ray tracing anything. We were doing things.
Although I think Weta was brute forcing it. They had like some really 20 hour long frame renders. And you know, some of the stuff, we got a sneak peek at it and it looked good.
Yeah.
But Paul George wasn't going to have any of that. He's like, no, we can't handle these render times. And and I was with RenderMan, which is a, you know, a
hybrid. Of course, I was probably naive me at the time. Was like, why are you talking about? We can ray trace everything, because I was a big V-Ray guy at the time. But it was. I think the solutions we found, and I think I've actually discussed it on a previous podcast with one of the guys about specifically how we would. Oh, it was with what's his name. I'm just name blanking right now.
Charlie.
Compositor.
Mark Rienzo.
No. Paul, not Paul Lambert. Anyway.
Mark Rienzo did the gizmo.
Mark Rienzo was part of it. And also obviously, who was also the DFX supervisor on it, who's now at DreamWorks, was a big Nuke guy. He wrote part of Nuke.
John Eggstadt?
John Eggstadt was also part of that. Jonathan. Anyway, we all learned a lot through that process, and I think it was a really fantastic thing to go through. And I learned a huge amount. And that interrogation scene was interesting because it was one of the most beautiful scenes in terms of how this robot looked. But it was also like, it's not that I would recommend you do this, not to use a scene that important and use it as your look development scene, because you want to have things figured out before you get to that.
Yeah. I mean, I was actually happy they chose it and that they let me, you know, be the lighting lead on that sequence. I was very happy with it because, for one, I did like the lighting environment. And I did love the concept of it. I love the concept of an AI entity being interrogated by a human and everything that plays with that. So for me, I was super excited about it. And I put in some late nights. You know, I had no problem with motivation back then with that. And I really enjoyed it. And I was happy with the result, the way that sequence looked. And we had some really great technical assistance from Chris Harvey.
Oh yeah.
The shader, he was writing. I mean, I'm not a shader writer. I just need help with, you know, people building me little boxes I can use, and I kind of spec out what the function of it needs to be. And and I never had any problems. Like anything I ever had to, you know, to get, was able to get it from either Chris, and I think Rom at Sampath had helped me out.
I think we should clarify this because this is important for people to know, especially in a day now when shader writing is not really done anymore as much.
No. Yeah. So, the shaders you have now to work, the PBR shaders, I mean, there's nothing more you need, you know, generally. Right.
Yeah, exactly. The point being that back when people think of shader writing, they may not realize that what we're actually talking about is people actually coding a shader from scratch, right?
Yes.
And
RenderMan was especially that way back then. You had little modules that you had to rig together. I mean, and everything was a cheat. We didn't even initially have a Fresnel function that we could use. It all had to be faked.
Right.
We did get that eventually later on.
Right. So I was a big part of my complaint was about the Fresnel, obviously.
And I heard you. And honestly, like, that was one of the better things that happened to me too, is like really understanding what Fresnel was.
Right.
And like at that point, my life would never be the same again.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a really, interesting point. So Chris Harvey would code the actual things, but shader, what people think of as shader writing is not actually writing, is just assembling a shader, which is what you were actually doing. So you would assemble things, and then you come to a blogger, it's like, there's nothing I have that can actually do this. So Chris Harvey would sit there and code a portion of this module that do that portion of what you want to do.
Yeah, and then, Paul George was kind of a guiding force in, you know, making sure we were always kind of staying on our lanes and, you know, saying whether we need this or need that. Like, is this, you know, do we need this? This is too much, you know?
Right.
And then we had Mark Rienzo on the compositing side, who was kind of an interface to what the compositors would be working with, because we couldn't ray trace and brute force it. We were dealing with a hybrid renderer, like a raise renderer, and rendering a bunch of components out and frame buffers, and those would be composited, you know, typical shader compositing that goes on even today. But we had to invent a lot of the passes that didn't exist back then, and to come up with this kind of a transblurrency surface, which could scatter light, you know, with depth, and it would be partial transparency, partial subsurface, partial scattering, all these things.
Really, what it was, we were giving Nuke all the tools it needed to just blur the image.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't really transparency. Yep. It was just like...
Yeah, it's a cheat. Everything is a complete cheat.
We're going to give you information like, okay, this is the amount, here's a path that tells you the distance between the exoskeleton and the soft tissue.
Yep.
And then we'll use that as a way to blur things.
Yeah, there was like face forward passages, general face forward, you know, that you can, a compositor could use. And yep. Mark, you know, I would work with Mark and come up with, we were trying to get a gizmo that the compositors could easily use. And I will, as great as Mark is and as instrumental as he was in helping, I have to apologize to all the compositors that worked on that show, because it was not the easiest thing to do to get, because, you know, the way light works in translucent materials is not predictable.
No.
And it was up to the compositor to, you know, because the lighting circumstances were always changing in the movie, and it was dynamic lighting. Characters are moving and the cameras are moving. So when you think about it, the compositor has to take essentially this massive cheat and reassemble the components of the shader to the point where it actually looked believable.
Right.
And it didn't always happen in the movie. And if anyone has seen the movie today, anyone who knows, you know, any kind of, you know, if you know dielectric materials and how they behave with translucency,
right,
there's a lot of shots that don't necessarily sell anymore.
Sure.
But there's some that did, you know, and so it's kind of but the compositor was often getting the brunt of that. You know, we'd go into dailies and see things and like, well, this doesn't look right. And then we also had the challenge of our director, who wanted the robot to look white, but, you know, you're talking about a translucent surface that doesn't always look white. It could look gray. It could look dark with odd highlights in it.
Right.
So that's the way translucent materials behave. So, you know, the good thing about the approach we had with the gizmo is that we could adjust the surface to make it fit the director's mood.
Sure.
You know? And we did use that. So when you see the movie, or, you know, most people have seen it, it's practically a... It's old theater at this point.
It is.
It's like.
But I want to give a little bit more.
Keep that in mind.
Give a little more context based on all this information of how complex it was. This was around 2004.
Yep.
This is about, you know.
2002 to 2004.
Right. So we're looking at least 15 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Computers had two processors. Each processor had one core.
Yeah.
and we're talking about maybe 1 gigahertz, maybe 2 gigahertz per core.
And we're talking RISC processors.
No. We had PCs at that time.
Oh, that's right. I'm thinking of my old job.
We did have PCs. Old job. And I think we had maybe 1 gig of RAM, maybe two.
Yeah. Maybe. Two was a really hot machine.
Really hot machine.
That was a hot-rodded machine.
Okay. So that right now, the phone that's in my pocket is like, you know, 20 times, 30 times faster than that computer.
Yeah.
So all of that, all of the ways that we had to cheat things was a way of getting around the issue that we were dealing with in terms of the fact that our computers were
actually
pretty
getting
weak.
Very good render times. I mean, a lot of our render times were sub 1 hour. You know, I think
we
were finaling shots at 45 minutes a frame. And
yeah.
So
it was really, really good. Now, we did a lot in Nuke as well to make that work, but it was actually a fabulous collaboration between compositing and lighting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I really credit Paul. You know, he kind of drove that kind of double-headed monster or approach, if you want to call it that. So, but, you know, that's kind of my indoctrination to the DD way, because the company I had left, it was a little bit different. You always, you know, hand it off to compositing and it just went into a black box. But at DD, you know, in those days, we had some pretty good collaborations between 2D and 3D. And
yeah.
They had some very talented people over there. So,
yeah, it was really kind of cool. But I don't want to necessarily skip over the rest of your visual effects career, because it was a pretty substantial. And you worked on some amazing films in visual effects. But I want to make sure we have time to talk about what ended up getting you to leave. What was the motivation that ended up getting you to leave the post world and go into the pre world?
You know, I never wanted to leave. I mean, I loved working on shots. I love seeing the result of your toils on the screen, and you know, your family back home could call it, oh, I saw that. You know, that's kind of a nice thing about working on post. I had a relationship with a friend who I went to school with, who was instrumental in getting me into visual effects. And he also was a transportation student at Art Center, but he, Rupen Sawanat is his name. And he, was really, you know, kind of a inspiration to me in many ways because he was so good working with studios at getting them interested in his ideas. And, you know, he's one of the pioneers of Previz, but he is also, become really good at developing projects for, you know, coming up with ideas and, you know, writing treatments and, you know, getting people in high places interested in his ideas. And so he always had something working, you know, while he was Previz directing, kind of on a back burner thing. And he a lot of times would kind of pull me out of my little cubicle at Digital Domain or wherever I was to and get me busy at home late at night working on his ideas. And, you know, we would also, there was a lot of interaction between us. So it was kind of a fun way for me to, you know, take all these creative urges I had from my younger days and, you know, not having anyone tell me, well, this is what you need to make, you know. Oh,
sure.
It's more like we need something for the story to work. You know, what can you come up with? And so there was a lot more conceptual going on, and that was obviously intriguing. And so like Lotus Caves was one of the first projects that, and this was something that was owned by Walden, and it's stillborn, but this required a lot of science fiction environments and vehicles. And so I think I'd worked for about 7 months continuously on one of those projects, and he was able to get me paid from Walden Studios.
Wow.
So I wasn't working, I wasn't making quite the same rate I had in post at the time, but I was making enough to do it without worrying about, you know, but it also meant leaving a nice comfy place like DD, no longer being staff. And, and I turned into a project employee because I was bouncing around so much that I wasn't able to, you know, I never had like a stable form of income at that point. And so I was kind of joining the ranks of a lot of the other freelance artists that work in pre-production and production where you're working job to job.
I remember even at that, you know, when I was a DD, you were sort of going, you were telling me about that. And you said, you know, I'm calculating as part of my life or whatever that I calculate how much I need to make in a year. And I try to get as much as of that income as I can in 9 months so that I can take 3 months off in a year and I won't feel it. Right?
Yeah. And honestly, you kind of need that bouncing between post-production and pre-production because the mindsets are so different. You know, one is kind of solving difficult problems at a plodding pace and, you know, using a different part of your brain. And then you have to jump over into pre-production and development and think very big picture and abstract and blue sky. And then just, it takes me a few weeks to change. You know, I can't just leave one job and go to the next. It just doesn't work. You need to kind of adapt to the new task at hand. So
yeah, because post-production can be very micromanaging of certain things. And then when you get into pre-production, it's like,
But one thing I really appreciated about Previz was that in development is that, you know, development sometimes is different. Development, you might be working in your underwear at 4 a.m. after you've tried to sleep but couldn't because, you know, it got you out of bed and this is what I'm going to do. And so that's one thing, you know, but no one's telling you to do it. You're telling yourself to do it. You know, post-production is like running in a train tunnel and seeing there's your deadline ahead of you and it's not. It's only coming towards you. It's not moving away from you. And so it's kind of there's kind of that aspect of post-production that makes it very difficult. But Previz, being you're early on in the schedule, a lot of the money hasn't been spent yet. A lot of the ideas haven't gelled yet. And so it's very enjoyable in that sense. And you never work weekends and you're rarely working more than 50 hours a week. And so you really have a chance to have a normal life in Previz. The pay is generally a little bit better too. So that helps. There's good things about both. And I will say, like, I would have a hard time going back into post-production at this point.
Yeah. I don't blame you. I mean, I think there's a good place for post-production for a lot of people that are not us anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's fine because those people need that opportunity to experience that. And I'm more than willing to step out of the way and let them do it.
Yeah.
Because I don't care about getting my name in a credit anymore. I don't care about this. And honestly, I just don't want to, you know, you can burn out on it and it's fine. I think it's a good thing to move along.
Yeah, and another thing I will say is post-production, the way you work is, you know, you have a problem that you're working on constantly for days and maybe a week or maybe even months. And it's all consuming. I mean, your mentality, especially when you're doing shaders for things that, you know, have effects that haven't been invented yet, or right. or at least not, I mean, maybe in various, you know, Carnegie Mellon University, they have a way to do, you know, like a halo on a specular lobe or whatever. Mm-hmm. But back, you know, back then you had to fake it, you know, so right. you're always trying to figure out how to solve these problems with RenderMan or whatever. It's not as technical as coding, but it's kind of nuts and bolts, and you're distracted and you're obsessed. And one thing is, it was really nice is when I started doing previs is when you're doing previs, and because you're working at this kind of myopic plotting pace in post-production, which doesn't make sense because you're actually closer to the release date of the film. But in previs, the pace is extremely fast because you're generating so much content. And I really had a hard time in the beginning when all my earlier jobs in previs were actually design jobs and, you know, mm-hmm. Matrix and Matrix 2 and 3. There was a lot of environment design, set design, and it wasn't so much dictated, you know, we weren't getting through a bunch of shots. But later on in my previous career, we started being, you know, things were, you're talking about a feature animation or you're talking about a movie with 2,000 visual effects shots. And you know, granted, we're not doing all 2,000, but we might be doing 500. Or 600.
Right.
And that might encompass
and a very small group of people.
And you're talking about like 12, 15 environments. And all those environments have to be built at the beginning of the schedule before the animators join.
Right.
At least, you know, you have to mock them up. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I had a difficult time, but it was a good thing for me because I was working at such a, I mean, I was getting so involved in doing the shader stuff at Digital Domain. And I was spending 3-4 months developing a shader system, which is unheard of now. But back then, when we didn't have ways to do anisotropy with, you know, you're mixing up conductives and dielectrics and transparent things, and you have to be cognizant of shader count because Maya's node, you know, management is so bad.
Right.
And, you know, DD, like having to figure out how like the accelerator suit on G.I. Joe, I had to figure out a way to render the entire suit with one shader, and it had to be conductive, dielectric, and transparent all at once. So I'd build like this big 7-headed Hydra creature that had like a bunch of different places to attach the shaders, but then, you know, you're driving it with one set of maps.
Right.
And so you would spend, I think I spent on that one, maybe 5 months, you know, 5 months building the shader and lighting system for G.I. Joe.
Right.
And you just don't get that anymore. And you don't need it anymore.
You don't need it anymore.
I mean, now you just drop the shaders down. You know, it's all UVing and matte painting and plug them in and, you know,
right.
a little bit of tweaking. And, you know, a couple of days later, you should have something pretty decent.
Yeah. I think that was the thing, to be honest. I mean, I know you and I have like debated about this. I think you really liked the idea of sort of building these things from scratch and doing all this amazing.
Oh, I loved it.
Right?
I mean, I love solving these problems, you know, I mean.
Yeah, and that is a wonderful problem. And I agreed that like it was really cool to go through your shader on iRobot. But at the same time, in the back of my head, I'm like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just ray tracing. Ray tracing would solve all of these problems.
Yeah.
And you just need a solid BRDF that can ray trace properly.
Although I am still very proud of my my transformer shader that was actually doing glossy reflections using point cloud data. It was all pre-baked. I had these kind of Rube Goldberg
pretty hacky
pipelines that I was really proud of at the time. And I couldn't really try and explain them to anybody except for, you know, my neighbor, Shuichi.
Oh, Shuichi, yes.
Who I should also mention, give a shout out to him because he's a really brilliant guy and created a lot of like awesome little functions for me. And, you know, any problem I had, like he was my guy.
Right.
And he helped many people at Digital Domain.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there was, I guess I should go back to where I was going with all this was that, you know, when you're solving problems with this kind of level of detail and myopia and, you know, you're really moving at a plotting pace.
Right.
And then I go into previs, you know, I think my first big previs show was like Alice 2.
Okay.
And I remember having them, you know, basically drop on me like 4 environments in one day. And right. So just me building four environments in one. So that's 2 hours per environment.
Right.
And it's everything.
Yeah, to like model everything.
Modeling, texturing, shade, lighting, all the, you know, foliage, everything.
Right.
And so that was kind of a shock to the system. But it was good for me to all of a sudden have to think about these kind of time scales. And I adapted. And I would say by the end of the week, I was knocking out a lot of stuff and I was building props. I was,
you know, I don't know if I could do
that. It was a crazy chronosphere vehicle and right. I was enjoying it.
Right.
And I was still leaving, you know, before 8 p.m. I think I was still not going beyond 10 hours a day.
Right.
And so I managed to kind of adapt to that and enjoy it. And, you know, I was happy to have my weekends back. And you just can't be so attached to the image you're getting, of course, being previous. But there is time at the end of the project, at the end of the schedule in previs, to start taking the animator shots and then fixing the lighting and going back and getting the environment to feel a bit more like it should.
Right.
Making the director happy in that way. Because even though, you know, some directors tend to be good about not being distracted by previs. The other guys, they tend to be motivated. The better you make the environment look and the shots look, the more ideas they get about what the character should be doing. And,
okay.
You know, it's kind of a creative process. You get a feedback loop going with you and the director.
Right.
And if the DP happens to be on board, then he's involved too.
Right.
And so I think in previs environments, you know, my job is basically to inspire the people who are making the decisions, you know, the big decisions as much as possible. So the film, you know, can be as good of a film as possible.
Right. So it's interesting because it reminds me of a conversation I had with someone that you also know, who is another Art Center guy, Eric Barba. And Eric Barba and I were having a debate at some point. Eric Barba and I would have some great heated debate, not heated, but debates about, you know, approaches of things.
Oh yeah.
And honestly, I think what's interesting is he seems like a hard-headed, stubborn guy, but when you really get involved in the debate and you offer him a really good point of view, he's actually
he can be reasonable.
He's very reasonable. He doesn't seem that way from the start, but he actually is very reasonable. But anyway, he gave me this conversation specifically because of his education at Art Center, which is about craftsmanship and about how to craft things and how to polish things and make things look perfect and beautiful,
yes.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's something at Art Center they pound into you,
right.
And you will bleed because of that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So his point was like, you know, when you're doing visual effects, you have to craft it till it looks beautiful, right? And then I told him a complete opposite point of view, which was from my architecture education, where nothing I create is precious. So therefore, if it doesn't work, I'd be willing to throw it away and not sit there and move on and go to the next thing. So to me, it sounds very much like your post-production was much more about the craftsmanship and your pre-production was much more about like nothing's precious, move on.
Yeah. I mean, that's for the most part true. I mean, I will say I always ended up with a few weeks at the end of any previous schedule where I would go back and just my old self would come out.
Sure.
And I would pull out the...
Well, why not, right?
I would pull out the cheesecloth and all the things at Art Center we use to polish the clay and,
right.
You know, test the reflections, like all the crazy stuff that they used to have you do in the model shop. I would end up doing it on the computer with this previs environment. And people would look at me like, what are you doing? Didn't we finish this sequence? Oh, you know, it's like, I just need a little bit better, you know, whatever.
Yeah, but no one will see it, so move on.
But the one thing, though, that Eric mentioned about, you know, polishing everything, and then you had mentioned about you kind of want to destroy it. And
right.
Move on.
Right.
At Art Center, they do actually tell you when you have your portfolio review that the purpose of your portfolio, the purpose of your work on the wall is for it to be destroyed.
Right.
So in that sense, you know, that does come back. And
that's good.
And because you need to divorce yourself, your emotions from the work at some point.
Yes.
Otherwise, you will never improve. You'll just be destroyed. And you just won't want to come to class the next day. So
I understand that. Yeah.
And you definitely have to. You know, to be able to accept, I made this, now time to
move on.
Yeah.
I think the reason that they taught it the way they did in architecture school is because they teach you criticism that's really hard, right? So when someone gives you criticism that your work is no good, which they will do.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure Art Center does the same thing. The approach is like, if this is no good, you need to find another solution. You need to throw it away. So therefore, don't feel attached you know, the same way, right? So philosophically speaking, it's the same thing. But I think as a in general, for anyone who's sort of getting into this field or understanding what they're doing, is like you have to realize that what you create, nothing is precious, and you have to give up that preciousness, and that the journey there is actually kind of the more important process.
The journey is more, that's where you're learning, and the more mistakes you're going to make, obviously, the more you'll learn.
So, right.
You know.
So I think it's really interesting to think about those two ways that education can help you, and how that worked in terms of your post-production and your pre-production work, is that it approached different ways. But so you mentioned, obviously, you know, how long you've been working in pre-production since, you know?
Well, I had started, you know, way back Matrix 2 and 3. I think I took a break from CineSide to do that. So that was my first foray into it, which, you know, lasted about, 7 months?
Okay.
A lot of these projects are 7 months. That number keeps coming up. It seems like Prev is, in general, is like 7 months. Unless you want to go work in Australia or New Zealand and, you know, go into Tech Viz or whatever, that goes on a bit longer. So, but I think it wasn't really until 2013 when I left DD. I mean, I had the option to go to Vancouver, and I wasn't into relocating, even though I thought it's a great city. So I think at that point I made a conscious choice to, you know, just start doing Previs full time.
Right.
So I put a lot more effort into, you know, lining up another project before the other one finished.
Sure.
So yeah, 2013.
Okay. So that's been a while. It's been a while, and you've been doing this for a long time, which is really cool. Yeah. I think that the Previs world is a fascinating one that I think a lot of people should look into and understand a little bit.
And it's changing quite a bit too.
It is.
It's kind of splitting off. It's forking off two different directions, which is it's a whole philosophical argument about
what directions.
I think primarily in feature animation, you're talking about using the gaming engine as a development platform.
Okay.
Because a lot of people now want to see how far they can push the look in development, and they're not even calling it Previs anymore. They're calling it, you know, development essentially.
Okay.
And then they're going to hand off these built assets and environments to, the post-production house, and they're going to just literally take the same assets, textures, UVs, everything, and try to, you know, obviously they'll have to finesse things a bit, but it's a much more literal translation from pre to post. And you know, with the gaming engine, obviously you got all these like lighting features built into your work that is closer to the final, you know, result. But then the other side of
so are they rendering it in real time for the final or not?
Well, that may happen.
Yeah,
I mean, I think there's been some characters rendered in hardware engines in some of the Marvel movies now.
Okay.
And you know, and I interviewed for a job doing a robot the final character render would be in a gaming engine. Uh-huh. But then the other argument for Previs, which I tend to agree with, as much as I'm focused on the final result and having something that looks pretty, is the goal of Previs is to come up with an edit, and it's to come up with the shot concepts, and it's to come up with the shot lengths and which character is in which shot. What, you know, assets you have in the shot, what's the fundamental lay of the environment. You want to solve all these problems in Previs so you can start your visual effects planning. And that's the whole point of it, is to save money and not necessarily to look pretty, because, you know, your DP hasn't been hired yet. And you don't know what the cinematography is going to look like yet. So there's all these things that'll happen later, you know, when you're dealing with live action plates. And one thing that, you know, I've had to learn also in Previs is to how not let things get too far distracted, you know, in Previs by what it looks like. As much as I want to make it look pretty, and I will try to make it look pretty, but the goal is not for it to look pretty, of course. The goal is for all those aforementioned things to be solved. And you know,
they need to know how to shoot it.
Yeah. And shows go a lot better, you know, when you know that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, so having a game engine giving you these really finessed, beautiful images with, you know, GI, and of course, a lot of it's pre-baked. It's not, you know,
it's not real.
Forward rendering, right? Like all these, you know, you've got a real time engine that's giving you a result that looks pretty, but that may not be what is desired in the final outcome. So where this is all going to go, I'm not sure, but you know, there's kind of two schools of thought that are going to meet in the middle, and we'll see what happens.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't really know where that world is going, and it's okay. But I do believe, virtual production is a thing that's happening.
Yep.
More and more.
I just interviewed with a virtual production, and it is an amazing thing to see.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think that virtual production is an important part of it. I think that the more there's always been this idea that visual effects is this black box that directors don't really have control over. And so they sit there and go like, here you go. 6 months later,
I'll tell you, without naming any names,
right.
The interview I just had was, a very large scale feature, production, $100+ million movie.
Mm-hmm.
The director's a young director and he knows what he's doing.
This is more common now.
Yeah.
Yes.
But the job was interesting because, it's like one of the functions of the job I interviewed for, it was almost a management position, but your job is to really keep the director from getting onto the artist machine and taking over and doing shots and
yep.
doing.
And that happens.
That's half the job. So
I know, like, for example, I did a podcast with Wes Ball, who, did all the Maze Runner stuff. Right.
Yep.
And so he actually rendered stuff on the first Maze Runner.
Yep. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So, yeah, I know. So that's the kind of stuff. It's like, he knows how to do it. It's like,
And yeah, then, no, he's good at it, too.
And Joe Kaczynski asked me what my noise threshold was on my V-Ray renders, So,
yeah. Not too many. I mean, it's hard for a producer to get in the way when that kind of thing is happening.
You know,
their name is director for a reason. You know, so.
But they long for those days where they got to what they're doing. So they know it's like, I want to render that myself.
Yep.
It'd be fun to do that, It's kind of like Tom Cruise not wanting to give up the job that the stuntman's supposed to do.
I know. Apologies to his ankle.
Yeah. But okay. So going back to that, I believe that, like I said, that the post-production goes into this black box and the director doesn't see anything for months and months and months. And then you're like, all he or she will see is something that's close to final, right? So they don't know the journey that it took there. They don't know the decisions that are made to make it there. And they're like, yeah, I guess this is what I wanted. I don't know. Maybe this needs to change, that needs to change, whatever. But if you go into virtual production mode and you actually do the production much closer to live action, but all in a virtual set, right? And they start to see, oh, I'm virtually moving a light like a DP would move it or this and that. Then suddenly the director, the DP, everyone can get involved in virtual production, and then it becomes, they're much more invested.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And therefore, as opposed to saying, I don't like CG, they can go, I love CG. So suddenly the director may go in there and go, instead of saying, oh, yeah, I really want an Arri camera and this and that, he says, no, I want, Unreal, I want it to be rendered in V-Ray, because they'll know that tool set in some way. It becomes part of their tool set, right?
Yeah.
So,
I found it.
Didn't you find it weird because you were lighter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you find it weird that pretty much you had the role of the DP in CG?
I love that.
I know, but you're not a DP, right?
No.
But
as long as you get a plate, it's more of a problem solving because you're essentially match the plate. That's a problem that you want to solve, and it's fun when you hit it.
Right.
But if you're essentially lighting a full CG environment, then you're a DP, and then that's also fun too.
I would rather work much more directly with the DP, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I think in the virtual production world, you can do that.
I think if you're working with someone who has a camera background, a physical camera background, that's amazing because you're essentially learning how light works and learning what's really going to happen.
Yep.
You're not so much learning how to cheat it because I think one of the, like for me, I'm actually not a big fan of visual effects films. When I most of the movies I see are independent films or, they're well shot, but there's no visual effects in them.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I hate the most, and I think it was probably for me a curse of my career, is sitting in dailies and I love, and granted, there's like so many talented people working and you see some really amazing work being done, but then some shots are just these monstrosities. There's no right solution for it. I mean, they're the pineapples that have lasted for a year in a schedule where there's like 300 elements and there was never a plate and, you're having to basically create reality and, you're asking a visual effects supervisor to lead that process. And after you've stared at something for 6, 7, 8, 9 months, a year, You really have to step outside of it, you know, or you have to do something like flop the image left to right, right to left.
Right.
You know, you have to start playing games to just get your head, you know, because you've already established these hardwired neural connections that have made you perceive something a certain way that's, yep, that's wrong. Yeah. And so it's really great to have people with camera backgrounds because they understand how a light works and they can immediately tell you, oh, well, if you look at this shot, you know, you've got the sun in the top right of the frame,
sure,
but how is it that you're exposing for these blacks and seeing into these blacks? That doesn't, right, that doesn't work, you know? And
right,
when the camera whips across frame, how come this doesn't change? Because, yep, now the sun's being occluded and, you know, you're not taking into account what a camera does. And so,
right,
those kinds of things are things that only people with that background typically get right.
And that's, again, going back to iRobot, we had that with Eric Nash because he was, yep, a DP, right?
Yeah, so I love those old school DPs for those reasons. And
right,
like a lot of times when you say, and there's some really talented people, I don't want to ruffle any feathers, but when you have someone that rises through the ranks of a 2D background, they may not always understand that as well. And it's not because they're stupid. These are all really brilliant people. It's just because they haven't, you know, risen through a practical background with, you know, knowledge of photography. And it's,
right,
they're really difficult problems to solve, you know,
yeah,
if you don't know that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, cool. Can you believe it, John? We're already at about an hour that we recorded.
Yeah.
It went quick. So I want to ask you, like, you know, what, you know, you're of course welcome to come back and chat more, which I would love to do. But is there anything you want to talk about? Like some of the stuff you mentioned that you're like, you cannot talk about most of the work that you've done because they're not made into movies yet.
Yeah, it's amazing, like when you do development stuff, how long things can sit on a shelf. And it's really excruciating because it's not just that you're not able, I mean, you can show your work in like a private one-on-one, but you can't advertise yourself. So
right,
you're not going to create demand for yourself and your skills. But what's worse is that your work ages, you know, it's sitting on a shelf and it's aging. The world is changing around it while it sits there.
Right.
And, you know, so you have to keep kind of loading up the, you know, you have to load up the pipe with new stuff that's going to sit on the shelf for 10 years. Just so at some
right,
point, something's going to come out.
But yeah, that's like,
I mean, I am
10
happy
years
to say that Godzilla is coming out soon in May, and I did a lot of work in that
right,
you know, I know, you know, I don't have to wait that much longer, so that'll be
but
nice.
You can at least mention that that work's coming out, and
yes,
you can talk about that.
That's coming out in May.
But
yeah,
there's several.
And one of the things I worked on is in the trailer, so that's good.
Okay.
This big flying wing ship that you'll see in the movie.
Nice.
I did some design work on that, and a Los Brevis environments there, too. That was a lot of fun to work on that movie with Mike Dougherty and And Mulan was another show I just finished that will be out, I guess.
Has that been announced?
I don't think it's been announced yet. It's
so being
shot.
So I don't know if should we probably cut that part out?
Yeah. I mean, it's not, it's a known story. And I had a lot of fun working on that with Grant Major, production designer. And he, you know, gave me a lot of kind of free roam to work on some of the set pieces in there. So I'll be excited when that one comes out too.
All right. Well, there's obviously going to be a lot of projects that you worked on that you can't mention, but you know, we should follow up on it in a year or so and say, okay, here's all the movies that I did work on that I couldn't mention last
yeah,
time.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I might be like Van Gogh where I'm gone, but you know, all of a sudden, not to compare myself to Van Gogh, but like, oh, he did that. Oh, well, he's not around anymore.
Right. So. Right. Yeah. Well, I do. I mean, this is years and years and years ago. I had just moved to LA. So we're looking at 2001 or something like that. And there were people that I knew that at that time were working on Avatar, and I didn't even know what Avatar was.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
And they had already been working on Avatar. This is in 2001.
Yep.
They had been working on Avatar for 10 years.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And so that means that people that were starting to do concept stuff for Avatar back in the 90s, and Avatar didn't come out to what, 2008 or
yep,
something like that.
Yeah.
So like this, that's how long somebody, so, you know, ridiculous.
Well, that's it. Yeah, when you're talking about an A-list director,
20 years, 20 years
is like one of the tent poles of the industry. That can happen.
Yeah,
you know, when you got Lightstorm and Cameron, but
yeah,
a lot of projects don't have that luxury. But you know, it would be a curse and a blessing to work on one, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so. I don't know. It's like some of those things, you know. At the same time, it's really cool to get really involved in that world. I'm sure the people who got involved in, you know, an Avatar, they knew that planet inside and out. They knew the geography. Yeah. They knew they had Latin names for the plants, you know, stuff. So
there are probably people in the cast and crew that walked around and set speaking the language of, I forget what's the language of the
Naboo, whatever it was.
Yeah. Yeah. They probably know how to talk. That's when you know you've been on a show too long, is when you know
the language,
the scripted language that's in.
I see you. Yeah. yeah, it's cool. All right. Well, John, thanks so much for doing this. It was really a lot of fun to be on.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. Yeah. I enjoyed it.